You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. Our guest today is Brian Shellam. Brian worked as a historian at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and prior to that was a career Army officer. He had a variety of troop assignments with tank units, served a tour as an Army attaché in Bonn, and did service on the staff of the 2nd Brigade 1st Armored Division in the Gulf War. He is a graduate of West Point and has gone on to do interesting studies, which we may touch on later, on some of the tactics being used by the insurgents in Iraq. What I'd like to do, Brian, as we start here, first of all, we're delighted to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. You're coming from DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's not an agency that many Americans know a great deal about. And I know that one of the primary field elements that DIA houses, of course, are the attachés and the attaché system. Wonder if you could just give us a sort of a thumbnail. What is DIA, primary function? And then let's move into that field of the attachés themselves and what role they play in the field.
Okay, DIA is a fairly new organization, created in 1961. Came out as a result of a lot of study that was done in the 50s. Actually, Eisenhower proposed a study group. He was not happy with the competition among the services and thought that there ought to be a way to coordinate the military services better. Resulted in a study that recommended a creation of a defense intelligence agency. Secretary McNamara actually put those findings into effect in 1961, created the Defense Intelligence Agency. It took a few years for all of the responsibilities from the services to be transferred over to DIA. So DIA, the last of those responsibilities was responsibilities for attachés in 1965. And then since then, and of course, in those first three decades, the main focus of DIA was on our main enemy at that time, the Cold War, Russia, and it's a military intelligence agency, defense intelligence agency. Basically, they are the premier military intelligence coordinating body for our Defense Department. Now, you know, it's changed over time, the focus and the mission. But that's basically how DIA came about.
Now, of course, each of the military services also has an intelligence component. I mean, the G2.
Yeah, that's correct, and they still have those. But that was part of the problem. But the missile gap and things that happened back in the early Cold War years. Actually, the service intelligence organizations were competing against each other. In some cases, creating intelligence pictures that supported their own budgets, or that was what was charged, and So Eisenhower basically got fed up with that and put together this study group that recommended a creation of a DIA.
Maybe it probably did, just like people say, it took Nixon to go to China. It took a military man to
That's
finally
right.
put
yeah.
the military folks together.
Who understood the military
like
better than
yeah.
than any president?
Yeah. So DIA currently is one of the major players. The DIA sits certainly part of the intelligence community. It certainly is a major participant in drawing up the national intelligence estimates and other estimates.
That's right. And of course, their mission really changed after the end of the Cold War. Part of that was the Goldwater-Nichols Reorganization Act of 1986, which made DIA a combat support agency. Support to the warfighter became real important. That combined with the end of the Cold War really changed the focus of DIA to support to the warfighter, along with support to the COCOMs. And then you had the Gulf War I, 1990 to 1991, where really DIA as a warfighting agency came of age, developed a lot of concepts to support the warfighter, and it's just gone since that.
You know, this is a bit of a sidebar question, but as you and I speak, the Secretary of Defense Gates is looking for major budget changes in the Defense Department, and also looking at what our military should be prepared to deal with in mm-hmm. the out years. And there seems to be a sort of a growing feeling that sort of doing more for the things that General Petraeus recommended, that is the special forces
sure.
and so forth. And I've got to assume that DIA is playing a major role in helping formulate what that new policy will look like.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. I mean, there's always been this tension between conventional forces and special forces. My personal opinion is you need both. You need a good mix of both. The problem is conventional forces are a lot more expensive, and right now the special forces are very, very useful in the current insurgent fights in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So that's going to be an ongoing debate.
Now, you mentioned that the last element of the military services to be folded into DIA was the attaché system. And tell us just a little bit about the system, and then what do attachés do? We all hear about a military attaché somewhere, or the military attaché was involved in such and such. And I think much of the public doesn't have a good, clear idea of the role of the military attachés.
Yeah. Of course, the military attachés became part of DIA in 1965, but they had been around a long time. The Navy Department, ONI, was the first ones to send out naval attachés, I believe, in 1882, followed by the War Department, the Army, in 1885 or 1888, somewhere in that time frame. And of course, they went out to the big European cities they were observers. They were there to observe and bring back. At the time, it was thought that the Europeans were more advanced and they could bring back techniques, technology. To the United States, so they were really out there to report on developments in Europe. The attachés, of course, grew over the years up to to around the turn of the century, 20 or 30 around the world, and then after World War I, of course, they continued to grow over the years. Where today, I think we've got I don't know what the number. The number is, but attachés really around the world. Now, I was an attaché, an army attaché in Germany, in Bonn, the old capital, the previous capital, currently in Berlin, from 1986 to 1989. So this is right at the end of the Cold War. The wall actually came down after I left that assignment, went back to a troop unit. An attaché has three jobs and three main missions. First, he's a reporter. He reports on developments in the country. He reports on military developments in the country. reports that, of course, back through DIA, through the ambassador, of course. Second mission is there's a representative mission. He represents his service in the Department of Defense in that country for visits, for cooperation, coordination between the militaries of the two countries. And then the last mission, one that's really forgotten a lot, is that he is the military advisor to the ambassador. He is actually an aide to the ambassador. That's why attachés wear aigulettes or the gold and yellow ropes, because they're considered aides to the ambassador. And really, their boss is the ambassador. The ambassador sets the tone on how much emphasis they give those different missions. So those are their main missions, and they vary from two people in the very small stations to very large groups and some of the bigger embassies.
Well, typically in the embassies, there's a leadership team, as it were, called the country team, and headed by the ambassador, and the military attaché, I have to assume, plays a very key role in that team.
Yeah, that's right. And so every attaché office overseas has one guy who's in charge. He is the defense attaché. That was also a problem when all of the different services had their attachés over there. There was a lot of duplication. Nobody in charge. You'd have an Army, Navy, Air Force guy over there. So this was one of the changes when DIA took over. There's a designated military attaché who is in charge of all the other attachés, and he is the representative who goes to the country team meetings along with all the other representatives, and is the single guy that the ambassador can talk to and give direction to.
Well, he would typically be the senior officer among the attachés, I would assume.
Correct. Usually, there are some traditions. Normally, for instance, Germany normally has as an army officer as the defense attaché. I know Oslo, Norway always had a Navy guy. But the problem is they're all, you might have an Army, Navy, Air Force, three colonels who all, are approximately the same rank, but one of those guys has to be in charge.
Sure. Okay. Does it, now I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I am. We of course have people in the, our installations overseas, our embassies and so forth, often who are collectors of intelligence. And I think attachés are, in effect, collectors of intelligence, particularly this reporting role where they're perhaps watching the National Day parade in that country, or going to, if there are military bases there and there's an air day or something mm-hmm. like that, visiting and so forth. But I certainly know we've read in the media from time to time about attachés perhaps pushing the envelope a little bit, and I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Well, pushing the envelope, I mean, that's a kind of a relative term. I know back in the Cold War days, especially, for instance, in the Soviet Union, if an Army attaché or a Navy attaché spoke Russian a little too well and was a little too aggressive in going and talking to the people, the Soviets didn't like that very much, and they might set him up or just declare him persona non grata, PNG, and send him out of the country. So it was sometimes it wasn't the aggressive attaché, but the country not liking what the guy was doing.
But I would assume that you do have some attachés who are, let's say aggressive collectors, that is, who will look for opportunities to conduct reporting that would be useful to.
Yeah. I would say that in the attaché preparation, before they're sent out, it's emphasized that you have to be a good steward in the host country, and of course it depends on what country you're in. I was in Germany, it was an ally, so
sure.
It's a far different environment than if you're in a hostile country. But of course, you have requirements and reporting requirements, and I suppose you have to take risks sometimes. But generally, I think you you know, you do a better job for your country if you're careful and you're a you know, good steward to your country.
Now, you were a you were in Bonn's Natasha. You were a German speaker.
Yeah, I was a German speaker. I was I was an armor officer, but I was also a foreign area officer. We have a kind of a split specialty system in the Army. So I was a German foreign area officer, a Western European foreign area officer. I studied German in through the schools and went to the foreign our language institute and I'm a fluent German speaker and one of the reasons why they sent me to the embassy in Bonn. So that's certainly I think that's perhaps one of the most important requirements is speaking the language of the country. It certainly makes your job easier and makes the host country respect you more that you actually speak their language.
Does DIA make a point of trying to prepare its officers with language training?
Sure.
For the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it can't be done all the time.
Right. One of the first things you do if you're going to get into, even if you don't speak the language, you're given an aptitude test. If you don't have an aptitude for learning languages, you're not going to become a foreign area officer. And then, they send you to school. And I had studied it before the military and at West Point, so I was already a fluent speaker, so I just got better.
You know, I'm fascinated when I was looking at your background to see that you published what is a very intriguing book. And the title of it is Black Cadet in a White Bastion, Charles Young at West Point. And I wonder, was your interest in Charles Young? I don't know anything about Charles Young. I wonder if you could tell us something about him.
Yeah.
But he sounds like he was a forerunner, if you will, of so many things that have happened in this country.
A fascinating character. I actually got interested in Young when I was working at the history office and at DIA, and we were trying to do outreach. We were trying to find subjects where we could actually go out to conferences and talk in public forums, and had an interest in attachés. I started reading about this guy, and there hadn't been a lot of research done. He was third black graduate of West Point, graduated in 1889, very early. He was the first black military attaché, served three tours. His first tour he served from 1903 to 1907 in Haiti, and then he served two tours later in the 1912 to 1915 in Liberia, and then 1919 until 22. He died on station on a confidential mission in Nigeria, serving as an attaché in Liberia. So, just a fascinating man. I started doing research, and then later on, decided to that the man deserved some research and a book, some attention. Besides being the first attaché, he had a lot of other distinctions. He was the first. This is kind of far afield, but he was the first black superintendent of one of our national parks. Back before the creation of the National Park Service, the U.S. Army patrolled our parks, so he was superintendent of Sequoia National Park. And a number of other things. Highest ranking black officer until his death in 1922. Really a forerunner for blacks in the U.S. Army.
That's quite extraordinary. I noticed you said he was deserving of a book, and I noticed you have a second book that you're going to come out with called Black Officer in a Buffalo Soldier, The Military Career of Charles Young.
Yeah, that covers his military career. My first book, published in 2006, University of Nebraska Press, just covers his early life up to graduation from West Point. This second book, which will be published early next year, really covers the rest of his life. His attaché tours, he fought guerrillas in the Philippines, National Park Superintendent, just a fascinating man, and certainly worthy of a book.
You mentioned he was the third black to graduate from the academy.
Right.
And I would just ask you, and when did he graduate?
He graduated in 1889.
Right. What sort of treatment was he accorded in the academy as a black cadet?
Yeah, I discuss that a lot in the book. Of course, not very good treatment. I did a lot of research to really find out. I mean, there were a lot of anecdotal stories, but anecdotes don't tell the story. So I tried to find, really get down to how he was treated. And he was not treated well. Many of his classmates, especially Southern classmates, treated him very badly. But I did find that he had some friends. White friends. There was one upperclassman while he was there who was a black upperclassman, John Hanks Alexander, who graduated 2 years ahead of him, that he was a roommate with. So he wasn't alone. He wasn't totally without friends. But it was a hard road for him at the academy at that time. And really, the academy closed the door. I mean, the first graduate was Henry O. Flipper, then John Alexander, then Charles Young in 1889. And that was that period after the Civil War where actually blacks had an opportunity until Reconstruction and Jim Crow laws. And really, the door closed to blacks at the academy and at West Point until 1936 with the graduation of Benjamin O. Davis, Jr. So nearly 50 years, there was a 50-year gap between his graduation and the next black graduate of West Point.
You know, it's interesting, having had a military career, really, and then going into a major agency in the intelligence community, the DIA. And we find a lot of young people listen to our podcasts. Mm-hmm. And as you take account of where we are and what's going on in the world and our role in it, what might you say to someone who would be considering a career in intelligence and specifically perhaps in military intelligence?
Yeah, I work with an awful lot of very bright, very motivated people in my current job. I did at DIA. I think it's a great challenging job. I would have people go to the DIA website. You can go to the DIA DIA.mil, www.dia.mil, and you'll find a history button there. You can press on that and see the History Office publications there. They're doing an awful lot of outreach, publishing the history of DIA. Preserving the documents of DIA, but also on that same page there's public affairs and jobs available at DIA, and I know they have a really vibrant intern program that goes on in the summer that's just about to start. So if you're a young person and you want to be an intern, there's opportunities there. But it's a great place to work. I would say, when I first got there in 1992 as a uniformed guy, there was an aging workforce, kind of left over from the Cold War, but they have, shortly after that, they started a real recruiting push to get young, bright people in there to kind of lay the groundwork for the future.
Well, I assume it must have been an advantage to have been a uniformed officer and then to leave the service and go into DIA with that background.
Yeah.
But what would you say to someone considering looking at DIA because they're interested in military affairs but they don't have military service? Would you recommend? I mean, what would your recommendation be?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, it's a fact of life that not many of us have military service today. I don't even know what the percentage. I mean, of course, we have a lot of folks in uniform in Iraq and Afghanistan right now, but most Americans don't have the opportunity, the privilege to serve in uniform. But that shouldn't be a reason not to. If you're bright, if you've got a degree in international relations or an interest in that, if you have a language, if you have an interest in a foreign country, there are great opportunities there.
Are there, in other words, if someone were to go into DIA and with an interest in foreign affairs, with an interest in a country, would they most likely have an opportunity to travel to that country, to visit, the, even possibly live in that country?
Yeah, there are options. There are options to be deployed all around the world. There's also the option to be deployed to combat zones, but normally those people are volunteers. But we have offices around the world. Defense attaché offices have civilians who are working in those offices. So certainly there are, okay. And around the country too. We have offices in Huntsville, Alabama, across the country.
Okay. Well, Brian Shellam, it's been a delight to talk to you today. I'm going to look for Black Officer and a Buffalo Soldier when it comes out. And what an interesting subject to pick, particularly in these times.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org.